Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Archeries Podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book. The Jakarta Method by Vincent Bevins is a work of modern history and investigative reporting that examines how anti-communist campaigns during the Cold War shaped political outcomes across multiple continents. Centering on the mass killings in Indonesia in 1965 to 1966 and the rise of Suharto, the book traces how a model of repression and state violence became influential beyond Indonesia, spreading as a template for eliminating leftist movements. Bevins connects declassified records, archival research, and on-the-ground interviews to show how local actors, militaries, and foreign powers interacted in a global struggle that was often fought through covert action, propaganda, and targeted terror, rather than treating these events as isolated tragedies. The narrative positions them as foundational to the political order that followed, including the survival of authoritarian regimes and the weakening of popular redistributive politics. The result is a sobering account of how mass violence can be normalized, exported, and remembered selectively. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, Indonesia 1965 to 1966 as the central case study. A core focus is the Indonesian catastrophe of 1965 to 1966, when hundreds of thousands of people associated with the political left were killed, and a major shift in power brought General Suharto to dominance. The book treats this not simply as a domestic upheaval, but as a turning point with international consequences. It explores how narratives about an alleged communist threat, combined with military organization and civilian participation, enabled a rapid escalation from political rivalry to mass murder. The Indonesian Communist Party, one of the largest communist parties in the world outside the Soviet bloc, is presented as a key reason global actors watched Indonesia closely. The book examines how fear, rumor, and propaganda helped define who became a target, and how detention, interrogation, and extrajudicial killing became tools of political transformation. By emphasizing the mechanics of the campaign as well as the human cost, it shows how violence was used to reorder society, dismantle labor and peasant organizing, and create conditions for a new political economy. Indonesia becomes the lens through which the reader can understand how Cold War priorities could align with local ambitions in devastating ways. Secondly, a repeatable model of anti-communist repression. The book argues that what happened in Indonesia became more than an event, it became a method that could be imitated. The term Jakarta Method captures the idea of a recognizable playbook: identify leftist organizations as existential enemies, use intelligence services and military structures to coordinate action, mobilize allies and militias, and then neutralize opposition through terror, imprisonment, and killing. The narrative connects Indonesia to later or parallel campaigns in places where military regimes and right-wing forces sought to crush socialist, communist, or populist movements. It highlights how the language of counterinsurgency and national security provided moral cover and bureaucratic clarity for brutal tactics. Importantly, the method is shown as adaptable. It could target guerrillas, legal political parties, unions, student groups, and even loosely defined sympathizers. The book also emphasizes the role of deniability and narrative management, where perpetrators framed violence as spontaneous public anger or necessary defense. By tracking the diffusion of ideas, training, and political signals, Bevins presents the method as an exportable framework that helped reorganize entire societies. The topic invites readers to consider how policy choices and institutional learning can normalize extreme violence when it produces desired political outcomes. Thirdly, United States policy, covert power, and Cold War incentives. Another major theme is how United States foreign policy operated in a Cold War environment where preventing perceived communist expansion often outweighed democratic principles and human rights. The book describes Washington as an influential actor that could provide diplomatic support, strategic guidance, and material assistance to Allied forces. Rather than depicting a single mastermind, it portrays a system of incentives in which local militaries and political elites understood what the United States wanted and acted accordingly, sometimes pushing further than outsiders directed. Attention is given to the tools of influence that were common in the era: intelligence cooperation, propaganda support, diplomatic recognition, and economic leverage. The result is a picture of power that is indirect but consequential, shaping which actors felt protected and which movements were isolated internationally. The book also underlines how anti-communism functioned as a global organizing principle, linking distant conflicts into one moralized struggle. This framework helped officials interpret events through a binary lens and helped justify alliances with repressive regimes. For the reader, the value of this topic is in understanding how superpower competition can distort local politics, reward extreme solutions, and create long afterlives for decisions made in the name of security. Fourthly, Latin America and the Echo of Jakarta. The narrative extends into Latin America to show how the Indonesian precedent resonated in a region marked by coups, counterinsurgency campaigns, and state terror. The book connects the broader anti-communist project to the rise of military regimes that frame themselves as guardians against subversion. It examines how political violence could be systematized through security services, coordinated repression, and cross-border collaboration among authoritarian governments. This part of the story emphasizes that the Jakarta method was not confined to one geography. It was a template that could be referenced explicitly or implicitly by actors seeking to eradicate leftist influence. The topic also explores why Latin America was especially vulnerable to deep inequality, powerful labor movements, and the existence of reformist or revolutionary alternatives that challenged traditional elites. The result was a harsh response that often targeted civilians, intellectuals, and community organizers along with armed groups. By placing Latin American cases in conversation with Southeast Asia, the book encourages readers to see patterns in rhetoric, tactics, and international backing. It also raises difficult questions about how societies recover from political violence, including the persistence of impunity, the politics of memory, and the struggle to build stable democracies after periods of mass repression. Lastly, Memory, Silence, and How Mass Violence Shapes the Present. A defining contribution of the book is its attention to what happens after the killing stops. It explores how states and institutions manage the story of mass violence and how official narratives can minimize, justify, or erase victims. The Indonesian case becomes especially significant here because decades of state-sanctioned silence and stigma affected survivors, families, and public understanding. The book links these dynamics to broader patterns. Truth can be inconvenient for regimes born from repression, and international partners may also prefer forgetting when past alliances look morally compromised. This topic examines how the aftermath influences political culture, including fear of organized dissent, weakened civil society, and constrained debate about economic and social alternatives. It also considers how the global triumph of certain Cold War outcomes shaped what many people came to view as normal or inevitable in politics and economics. By treating memory as a battleground, the book shows that history is not merely what happened, it is also what is allowed to be remembered. For readers, the lesson is practical as well as moral. Understanding how narratives are constructed can sharpen media literacy, improve civic judgment, and help societies recognize early warning signs when leaders again portray political opponents as existential threats. In conclusion, this book is best suited for readers who want to understand the Cold War beyond familiar European flashpoints, including students of history, journalism, international relations, and human rights, as well as general readers curious about how today's political landscape was formed. It benefits the reader by connecting local tragedies to global systems, showing how ideological fear, institutional incentives, and international alliances can make extreme violence appear strategic and acceptable. That understanding can deepen civic awareness, especially when modern politics again features dehumanizing rhetoric, misinformation, and calls for security at any cost. The Jakarta Method is worth buying compared to similar Cold War histories, because it integrates Southeast Asia and Latin America into one coherent account and foregrounds the mechanics and consequences of mass violence, rather than treating killings as a footnote to diplomatic strategy. It also stands out for its reporting-oriented approach, emphasizing human experiences while still engaging with documents and broader geopolitical patterns. Readers come away with a clearer sense of how power can operate through plausible deniability and how the aftermath of repression continues to shape institutions, economies, and collective memory. If you want a single, readable narrative that links overlooked events to the world you live in, this book offers strong value. If you would like to support Vincent Bevins, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.